Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. Check us out online at lost-origins.com and make sure that you sign up for our free newsletter. We're going to be rolling out a bunch of contests, merchandise, t-shirts, and perks for anyone who signs up for that newsletter, so make sure that you get in on that now. You can also connect with us on social media. We are on almost every single platform, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Make sure that you hit that like or subscribe button. That way you're always up to speed with all things Lost Origins and that you never miss an article or an episode. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, and alternative health for well over 40 years. You can visit innertraditions.com to learn more about their authors, their books, sign up for catalogs, coupons, and special offers. Some of my all-time favorite books have been published by Baron Company and Inner Traditions, and so we highly recommend that you pick up any one of their books. We promise you will not be disappointed. All right, folks, I am very, very excited for this week's show. Today, we will be chatting with historian, author, and explorer, Dr. Tudor Parfitt. Dr. Parfitt is often referred to as a modern-day Indiana Jones, and his research surrounds several topics, including the Lost Tribes of Israel and the Ark of the Covenant. So today we're going to be discussing his theories and his research surrounding the Lost Ark of the Covenant, his identification of the Lost Tribe of Israel, and his views on how this impacts history right after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, and we are back. I am so excited for today's show. Today, we are joined by historian and author Dr. Tudor Parfitt. Dr. Parfitt has authored droves of books, including The Lost Ark of the Covenant, Lost Tribes of Israel, and Journey for the Vanished City, The Search for the Lost Tribe of Israel. He has also made several documentary appearances, including TEDx, Quest for the Lost Ark, and most recently, Season 1 of Secrets of the Bible. Today, we're going to be discussing his theories and research surrounding the Lost Tribes of Israel, as well as the Ark of the Covenant. So, without further ado, it is my outstanding pleasure to welcome Dr. Tudor Parfitt to this week's episode of Lost Origins. Dr. Parfitt, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure, Andrew. Nice to be here.
Yeah, very good. We really appreciate you taking the time. I know that you're a very busy man, so it means a lot to us and all of our listeners out there that we get to have you on the show this week. So before we dive into your work and your journeys, could you please provide our listeners with a bit of your background?
Well, I'm from the UK originally, and I've been living in Florida, where I teach at Florida International University for about 4 years. And I was born and brought up in Wales and then Leicestershire in England. I had a big change in my life when I was about 19. I went to Israel on the British equivalent of your Peace Corps, which is called Voluntary Service Overseas, and I worked in Jerusalem for just over a year, and that really rather changed the direction of my life because I started learning Hebrew, and then when I went back to England, I studied at Oxford University, and there I engaged in Hebrew and Arabic studies, and then I went on from there.
Interesting. And so I'm sure you found this in your time in the Middle East, but the Middle East has a rather brutal history. Can you maybe explain for us some of the background on some of the Israelite tribes and how they found themselves in exile?
Well, the story goes way back to the 7th century before the Christian era, when there was an act of ethnic cleansing perpetrated by the Assyrians, who'd invaded northern Palestine. Hmm. And they took the considerable numbers, presumably the elite of the 10 northern tribes, into exile in Assyria. And that's the beginning of the story of the Lost Tribes of Israel. The Lost Tribes of Israel were those 10 tribes that they took. Mm-hmm. And the real problem came because the Bible was very, very clear about one thing, and that was that in the fullness of time, towards the end of days, the Lost Tribes would be gathered together in the land of Israel. They would return to the land of Israel, and that, of course, implies that they must have had an ongoing existence. So it became axiomatic for not only for Jews but also for Christians that somewhere in the world the Lost Tribes existed. And this myth became extraordinarily important for instance, medieval Christians, medieval Jews, and because people didn't know what was on the other side of the horizon, who lived there. They didn't know anything about the denizens of the African interior. They didn't know who lived, you know, beyond the Caucasus and in the Far East and so on.
Sure.
And so they imagined that somewhere across this shimmering but unknown horizon, the Lost Tribes of Israel were to be found hidden behind the Sambatian River, as they imagined it to be. And the characteristic of this river was that it flowed for 6 days a week, except it wasn't water within the river. It was hurtling boulders. Hmm. And on the seventh day it stopped, and that was the only day that it was possible to cross. But in the case of the Lost Tribes who lived on the other side of it, because they respected the Sabbath, they wouldn't travel on the Sabbath, and so therefore they could never, in fact, cross this river. And the only reason, of course, that the river stopped on the Sabbath was that it was a holy river, and it was a river that followed the commandments that on the Sabbath you should not work.
Fascinating. So what actually drew you in then to start researching the Lost Tribes? I mean, did you have like a first big break or a big lead that kind of tipped you off with respect to this ancient mystery?
In 1984, at the height of the great Ethiopian famine, I was asked to go to the Sudan, which is just to the west of Ethiopia, and you know, look into a particular story, which was that the Ethiopian Jews, sometimes known as the Falashas, were being poisoned in the refugee camps by Christian refugees. Hmm. And so off I went, and I got to these camps where people were really in the most incredibly bad shape, and located the Ethiopian Jews. And it just so happened that my arrival there coincided with the famous Israeli operation, which was called Operation Moses, which basically rescued the Ethiopian Jews, both from these camps and from Ethiopia, and they were taken to Israel, where they still are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And one of the myths, or at least one of the stories about the Ethiopian Jews, is that they were, you know, a lost tribe of Israel. In this particular case, they were considered to be the lost tribe of Dan, and this was a very, very old story going back at least 1,000 years, and so it has some kind of authenticity as a result of, you know, the longevity of the myth. And so that, you know, that sparked my interest in this particular thing. I wrote a book or two about the Ethiopian Jews, and then I started getting interested in Africa. Mm-hmm. And not much after that, I was invited to go and give a lecture in South Africa on the subject of the Ethiopian Jews. And at the back of the hall, there were some black people, quite shabby looking compared with the audience in the lecture room that I was talking.
Sure.
And they turned out to be members of the Lemba tribe, and they explained to me that they were also a lost tribe, like the Ethiopian Jews. And so that was the beginning of another long adventure.
Hmm. So the Lemba tribe then, why don't you tell us a little bit about them? Who are they? How are they connected to Judaism and then also to the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, of course, at the time, I knew nothing at all about the Lemba.
Sure.
So when I first met them, they said, come along to our villages and spend a few days with us. You'll soon see that, you know, we are what we say. And so off I went and spent a week or so with them. And they're living in, you know, grass huts right up on the border between South Africa and Mozambique. And at the end of the time, I thought, yeah, there's something in this story. They clearly are Semitic in many, many ways. And I went back to England, went to see Lord Weidenfeld, who was one of the great British publishers in the post-war period, and told him my story. And he said, sounds great, you know, why don't you go off and do a journey, try and find out what the truth of this story is. And so I went off for 6 or 7 months, and a good deal of it was on foot. And my idea was to follow the oral tradition of this tribe across Africa and see where it went. And so it was fascinating. I was able to pick up clues, you know, going from one village to the next, all sorts of things, both about their practices, you know, many of which seemed to be Jewish in some way, and indeed, you know, clues as to where originally they came from. But eventually I kind of got stuck. I got as far as the Indian Ocean, and, you know, that was the point at which the clues seemed to dry up. But by this time, I'd written a book. You know, the book was there. It was all about my adventures. It was about their traditions. But I wasn't able to either definitively say where they were from, although they clearly came from the East African coast. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't able to say whether they were Jewish or not. And so the book went. It did quite well. It was translated into quite a few languages. I was very interested in the story. But I kind of moved on. And a couple of years later, I was in the Yemen, in the bit of the Yemen which is called the Hadramaut, which is a valley system underneath the great Arabian desert known as the Empty Quarter. And I was speaking to somebody there, and he gave me a clue that really changed the whole history of the Lemba, connecting them with a deserted city which he claimed was at the end of the valley a few hundred miles to the east. And I was able to find that deserted city. And then I went back to this text and decided that the only way really to solve the puzzle of where they were from and who they were was through the recently evolving, you know, science of genetics. And this was now in about 1998, 1999, when it was new. Now everybody does it, but I think this was one of the very, very first times that population genetics was used to solve a, you know, a historical puzzle.
Right.
And it worked in the sense that it was clear that the Lemba were not from Africa, and that they were from the Semitic world, which is to say from Arabia. And there was another quite amazing thing which nobody could conceivably have imagined before, and that was that one of their bits, you know, genetic bits, which was called, which was subsequently called the Cohen-Mertel haplotype, showed that they had a connection with Jewish priests. We'd done a study the previous year. I was one of the co-authors because we'd had a bit of an insight. And the insight essentially was that, you know, you become a Jewish priest by being the son of a Jewish priest. And he's a Jewish priest because he's the son of a Jewish priest.
Right.
And so the insight was that this, you know, status of being a priest works in exactly the same way as the as the Y chromosome. You have a Y chromosome because your father had the Y chromosome, and he gets his Y chromosome from his father and so on. And so we put these two things together and we realized that if we looked at the Y chromosome of priests, it should, in theory, go back, if the story is true, to the founder of the priesthood, who in this particular case is the mother of, is the brother of Moses, Aaron. And we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of priests, and we discovered that an incredible 55% of them were descended from a particular individual who lived, wait for this, in northern Arabia, which is to say Palestine, Israel, about 3,000 years ago, more or less. Wow. The time of, you know, Aaron and Moses. So, you know, it made a huge story. It was on the front page of just about every newspaper in the world, and I had my 20 minutes of fame on 60 Minutes and so on and so forth.
Sure.
So, you know, that was a kind of very, very interesting thing. It seemed to show that, well, they were from the Middle East, and it seemed to indicate that their own traditions, claiming to be a kind of lost tribe of Israel or to have Jewish roots or to have something to do with the Jewish people, had something in them.
So then how did the Lemba make their way into Africa? And then what is their connection to Zion, right?
Well, we don't know. We know that the original group was probably quite small. One geneticist was able to figure out that there were seven people, which goes along with their own tradition that seven people arrived in a boat. And so, you know, the tribe was formed from this original population. And that would make sense. Mm-hmm. The east part of Africa was very connected with the rest of the Indian Ocean before the coming of the Portuguese at the end of the 15th century. We know that, you know, the Chinese had trading links, as well as, of course, Arabia and India. And so for some Jews to be involved in some of the great trading entrepôts of the East Coast, places like the city of Sofala, which was an extraordinarily beautiful and sophisticated trading city, it's entirely probable that there were some Jews living there. So that would seem, anyway, to be one great possibility for the origin of the Lemba.
Hmm. Fascinating. When you were in Africa, though, in researching the Lemba tribe, I mean, you were directly put into harm's way. I mean, that's not exactly a safe part of the world. On your journeys, what challenges did you face in Zimbabwe while you were trying to complete your research? Were there any stories or events that were, you actually feared for your life?
By and large, it was fairly safe. Living in an African village, you know, miles away from a hospital, hours away from a telephone in many cases, has its challenges, obviously. And, you know, there were wild animals. You know, one of the things that happened as a result of the mismanagement of Zimbabwe was that it was impossible to get, you know, bullets and powder and things like this for firearms. So there was an enormous increase in the presence of lions and other predators in the little villages I stayed in. So that was one danger. And on a later journey, I was in a tent, you know, in the middle of savanna country, and lions circled the tent at night. It was quite scary. On one occasion, I was ambushed and shot at, and I had to drive, through the brush barricade that they'd put up to ensnare me. Luckily, I wasn't hit. And then part of a later journey, which still had to do with this particular story, this is in the Yemen. By this time, Al Qaeda had started to implant itself there, and they were kind of on my tail. And that was a relatively narrow squeak because they were minutes away from where I was hiding out in a particular place down the Hadramaut. Wow. And I was tipped off. So, you know, I escaped. I've been very, very lucky, no doubt about it.
Well, it sounds very unnerving. I mean, I've always wondered, you know, we've had several people on the show. Andrew Collins was on the show recently talking about his journeys to Göbekli Tepe in southern Turkey. And I've always wondered, you know, when you have boots on the ground so close to turmoil, you know, how safe can that really be? So, I mean, that's just how lucky and fortunate you were to come out of that unscathed. That's incredible. Before we talk about the Lemba connection to the Ark of the Covenant, I do want to ask you, I mean, you know, all of us have become very familiar with the Ark of the Covenant because of Hollywood and Indiana Jones and whatnot, but I want to get your take on what you think the Ark of the Covenant was actually used for. What function did it serve? What was its purpose based on your research?
Well, it's a very interesting question. And, you know, there are slightly conflicting accounts of it in the Bible. And the best known is that the ark was made as basically as a recipient for the tablets of the Ten Commandments, which sure. were carved on stone. And, you know, the idea was that this thing was, it was made of gold. It was gold which overlaid a particular wood, acacia, which grows in the Sinai Desert, which is where this story happened. And it was carried on poles by the priests. On top of it, there was a lid, so to speak, and each side of the lid, there was some sort of a monster, you know, looked something like an angel, but it would have been much more fearsome than that. Mm-hmm. And the space between these creatures was considered to be the most sacred spot in the universe, and that was God's dwelling place, as it were, mm-hmm. on Earth. So massively important. Inside it, there were various, you know, magical or religious objects, including the tablets, mm-hmm. Some manna, and the stick of Aaron, and so this, the idea was that this should be carried in front of the Israelites as they crossed the desert, and this apparently they did. And eventually it was placed inside the temple in what's called in Hebrew the Devir, which is the Holy of Holies. Mm-hmm. And on one occasion it was taken out, it fell into the hands of the Philistines, didn't do them much good ultimately, but then it came back to the Israelites. And then it kind of disappeared, and nobody knows what happened to it. And there are all sorts of theories and versions and so on, and there have been hundreds of books written about, you know, what may have happened to the Ark of the Covenant, and there are incredible number of charlatans out there who have, you know, made careers about you know, stories connecting it with the Templars and all sorts of the Cathars, all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And it's all complete and utter rubbish. And I'm not claiming to have found the Ark of the Covenant by any means. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I mean, it's funny because, you know, when I was doing my research to start with, living in these African villages, you'd sit round at night, round a fire, and you'd probably have a bit to eat. You might have a drink. They love to drink a kind of beer, which is like porridge. It's got the consistency of thick porridge. Hmm. And you drink this stuff, you get a bit high on it, you know, and mm-hmm. they loosen up, they tell stories. And so one of the stories that they kept telling was the story of their magic drum. And so the magic drum was carried on sticks on the shoulders of the priests, and inside it there were various magical things that they needed for different purposes. And occasionally, very much like the Ark of the Covenant, it would zap people in one way or another. And the Ark of the Covenant was fond of killing people. It killed quite a number of people, according to the biblical account. And it had some magical, unknown technology involved in its construction or the way it operated. And so it was with this drum, which was called Ngoma Lungundu. And of course, you know, when I was listening to this story, I thought, well, I mean, this sounds exactly like the Ark of the Covenant, and I presume this is a story that these people have heard from the missionaries, and they've connected it to some tribal tradition of theirs. And I didn't take it seriously. When I wrote that book, Journey to the Vanished City, I mentioned it en passant as being a kind of interesting, you know, tribal legend, but it was not one that I really took very seriously at all. And the change came when we did this DNA work, and we discovered that among the Lemba, the genetic component, which is characteristic of the Jewish priests who at some point in the past had officiated at the high temple in Jerusalem, was actually shared by Lemba priests. Now, the chance of this being a coincidence are billions to one against.
Right.
There had to be a connection. And so all of a sudden I'm confronted with the thought, well, these people who carried their drum on sticks, like the Ark of the Covenant, and who themselves are descended from this very same individual 3,000 years ago who lived somewhere up there and who may have something to do with Moses and Aaron, this is just, there must be a connection.
Right.
So that's the story. And, you know, the deeper I got into their own legends about what the Ark had done in times past, how it was able to defeat enemies, how it was able to explode and, you know, do these terrible things to people, made it seem to me to be exactly the same phenomenon as the Ark of the Covenant. And, you know, according to their own traditions, this thing would blow itself up from time to time. And so I think that the one that I found a few years ago was, so to speak, the son or the daughter of a previous one, and that's more or less what they said. And what they argued was that this one was created about 500 years ago, and at the core of it there was a piece of the original one, and no doubt that one as well had worn out, you know, or its predecessor had worn out. Because it was used for war, it was used for magic, it was used for lots of different things. But in fact, it turned out to be rather older than that, because we had a carbon dating done on the on this object, and it turned out to be the oldest wooden object that had ever been found in sub-Saharan Africa.
Oh, wow.
And it took it back to the time of the Crusades. And so if you imagine a couple of other ancestors, it's not very, very difficult to take it back to biblical times at all. So that's, you know, that's the story. It would be very, very nice to do more research on this extraordinary object. But unfortunately, it's not possible to do so because, as you know, Zimbabwe is... you know, it's a one-party state, pretty much, even though there are two parties. It's and Mugabe has allegedly, I don't know definitively if this is true, but it is said that he has taken the Ngoma, the drum, or the object, into his palace, and he uses it, you know, for his own magical purposes. He's quite an old man. He wants to carry on in power. He believes deeply in magic, and this allegedly has got some rejuvenating powers, or so he thinks.
Sure.
And so for the moment, that's where it is, I think.
So it's mind-blowing to me, though, that we're not talking about just the Ark of the Covenant. We're talking about a lineage of arcs. And that's something that I had never heard before until I encountered your work. I think it's so fascinating. Have you ever found evidence of another arc, or was it just the one that you were able to get your hands on, so to speak?
Well, strangely, if you read the Bible attentively, it becomes clear that even then there was more than one ark, because the second time that Moses goes up Mount Sinai, the stones having been broken, God speaks to him and says, make yourself an ark. And on this occasion, you know, he's not down in the valley surrounded by the Israelites, mm-hmm. and there's no Bezalel, who was the artisan who made the first ark, on hand. It's just him with a penknife on the mountain. And so he has to carve a, you know, something that that the stones could be put in. Now, that would have looked, I mean, I think if you think about it, like what you can make with an ark out of a tree is going to look very much like the thing that I found. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know very much about the history of this wooden, simple object, but some of the Jewish scholars take it up. They see the inconsistency. They see that there are two. This is in the book of Deuteronomy, by the way. And they say, well, yeah, the first one was the ceremonial ark, but the wooden one was the ark of war.
Hmm.
And subsequently, there are plenty of traditions among the Arabs, for instance, and by later Jewish exegetes, talking about this ark of war, this second ark, and what might have become of it. And there's even a very complex Arab source purporting to describe the ownership of it over many, many, many hundreds of years. And bizarrely, in the Yemen, where I have reason to believe the Lemba at least passed through on the way to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'll never have a definitive answer, I don't think, to this, but there are some clues certainly leading us to suppose that at some point a wooden object that was connected at least with the tradition of the Ark of the Covenant found its way to Arabia and then passed with these seven men in a boat to the east coast of Africa.
Wow. So if we have multiple arcs, then I'd love to get your take on the theory that's been popularized by Graham Hancock in his book, The Sign and the Seal, that the ark or a ark is residing in Ethiopia. Have you put much thought or research into that theory?
Well, of course, I've had to confront it, and I'm interested in Ethiopia because of the Ethiopian Jews, and as I said, I've written quite a lot about them. I'm not a great admirer of Mr. Hancock, it must be said, and I don't think that there is any real evidence that an ancient ark ever got to Ethiopia. What there is a very, probably fairly recent tradition going back to early medieval times, mm-hmm. that the Queen of Sheba, which the Ethiopians believed to be an Ethiopian queen, went, as we read in the biblical account, to Jerusalem and was impregnated by King Solomon. And in due course, the son of this union, who initially returned to Ethiopia with mother, went back to Jerusalem to study with King Solomon,
mm-hmm.
and then went back to Ethiopia, taking with him the Ark of the Covenant,
mm-hmm.
Along with 200 Israelite nobles that the king had given him as a kind of retinue,
mm-hmm.
but he stole the ark. And so that's the basis of the story, and it's clearly there to aggrandize you know, the glory and honor of the Ethiopian royal family mm-hmm. and tradition. Now, there is no mention of the ark being in Ethiopia before about the time that the thing that I found was made, about 1300 and something. Mm-hmm. So it's a relatively recent story.
Sure.
Now it's supposed to be in a particular monastery. And, you know, with many of these people like Hancock, they come up with these fanciful ideas, but they actually fail to produce an object. And all of these stories, think if somebody's got an object and you can analyze the object and you can put it under, you know, you can put it under a microscope, you can touch it, you can feel it, you can do something with it, then I think it's worth talking about. But in his case, there's no object. It just says that it's inside this monastery and is guarded day and night by two priests, and we'll never know for sure, but that's where we think it is. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. Well, I can do better than that in this particular case, because it just so happens that I used to be at the School of Oriental and African Study in the University of London, mm-hmm. and the arguably the greatest scholar of Ethiopian studies was one Professor Edward Ullendorf, who died a few years ago. And as luck would have it, during the Second World War, when he was wearing the uniform of a British officer, he went along to this very church, and he was told, "Oh, no, you can't go in, you can't go in." He said, "Well, I'm actually going to go in." And they couldn't do very much about it. He marched in with his troops, and he saw what purports to be the Ark of the Covenant, and he stated very, very clearly, although he never wanted to publish this, because it would have been offensive to Haile Selassie, who was a friend of his, and he admired him very much, and his life had to do with Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't really say this to Ethiopians without causing great offence. But he did actually speak to a journalist once, and it was published in a newspaper. But I was his colleague for many years. I've heard this from him directly. He said, well, it's the same kind of thing that you find in any Ethiopian church, because in any Ethiopian church there is an Ark of the Covenant on the altar, every single one. They're modern. You know, it's just a feature of Ethiopian churches that this particular kind of artifact is to be found. This one was of no great antiquity. It was very similar to the sort of thing that you'd find in any relatively old church throughout the country. So it is definitively not there. There are other theories saying that it might be in the Vatican, mm-hmm. that it might be hidden under a monastery somewhere in Judea. There was a recent book to that effect. And once again, you think, well, you know, fine, we'll dig up a bit and see if you can come up with anything. But simply to say that, you know, it's underneath this monastery, but we can't touch it, obviously,
right,
is not very satisfactory.
Sure. Well, I do have a bit of a controversial question for you. One of our listeners wrote in for today's show, and they wanted me to ask you, what are your thoughts regarding the Ark, or one of the Arks, having been buried at Oak Island?
Well, I know of the story. I think there's zero evidence, to be honest, that mm-hmm. That there was any such crossing of the Atlantic either by ancient Israelites or by any of their objects. So I think that really is an area of total fantasy.
Okay. So do you have any new projects or upcoming books that we can anticipate? How can our listeners follow your work online? Like, do you have a website? How can we stay up to speed with all things Dr. Parfit?
Well, it's very kind of you to ask. I'm a bit old-fashioned, so I don't have a website, but there's plenty of internet traces of my doings. Mm-hmm. recently I've been working on a very interesting story, which has got to do with the, you know, the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal. And as you know, at the end of the 15th century, the Jews were expelled in 1492 from Spain, 1497 from Portugal. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, in many cases, they were forced to convert to Christianity, and they turn up in the Americas. And over recent years, they've started being aware of this tradition and, you know, coming out to claim their heritage. And this includes people living in, you know, the most remote parts of South America and Brazil and Amazonia and Africa and Asia and so on. And so that's a very, very interesting story, and I'm working on that particular thing at the moment.
Very cool. Do you have kind of an anticipated release date, any time that we can expect that new piece of work?
Well, I would think, yes, within I've got a couple of academic books coming out towards the end of this year. If anybody's really interested academically, they will find them online. And I think in terms of a popular book, I don't mean a popular book, a more accessible book, probably towards the end of next year.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Parfit, I really appreciate the time today. It means so much to me that you took the time out of your day to come on the show to talk to me. I know our listeners were very excited for today's episode. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed the talk.
Very good. Likewise. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We had a blast here in the studio this week. Make sure that you get online and check out Dr. Parfit's research. You can order his books through Amazon. And get on Netflix and check out episode 1 of Secrets of the Bible. That whole episode is dedicated to his work. Make sure that you tune in next week when we are going to have the outstanding privilege of chatting with Dr. Chris Hardy. Dr. Hardy's research is mind-blowing, and it surrounds the Anunnaki, who they were, and compelling evidence for our species history. Until then, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you to continue to question everything.